they'd all like to be. But she don't shine for the rest of the world. She's too busy shining on me. Shining on, shining on, shining on. Shine on, though the world will never see.
The sun comes up and brings the dawn as usual, and I awake, I find you gone as usual, but I can't find the way to let this crazy heart of mine forget. I pretend you're still beside me as usual. Each evening I take a walk as usual. I make believe that we still talk as usual. People always stop and stare. I guess they just don't see you there. Don't they know you'll always be right here as usual? Today I looked into my mirror as usual. I told myself that you're still here as usual. And as I stood there telling lies, the tears began to fill my eyes. 'Cause I know I'm only fooling myself as usual.
Eddie Arnold wrapping up the first set of music here of a Brenda Lee mock here on the Viva La Mock radio program. Let's figure out what songs you heard in that set of music. Before the Eddie Arnold, how about something from George Jones doing Shine On? Before that, Marshall Crenshaw name-dropping Brenda Lee with his song I'm Sorry, But So Is Brenda Lee. Nick Lowe from about a year ago, maybe 2 years ago, a single he put out doing Here Comes That Feeling. Percy Sledge in there as well doing his version of If This Is Our Last Time, and start off the entire set of that set of music with Sandy Denny doing her version of the song in the background. Let's Jump the Broomstick. That's half the songs. I picked out a dozen, not a baker's dozen, not just under a dozen. I picked out 12 songs that I wanted to hear and play as far as part of this Brenda Lee mock. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get back into it with how about something from Dottie West? Doing one of Brenda's biggest hits, if not the biggest hit from Brenda. It's I'm Sorry here on the Viva La Mock radio program.
I'm sorry. So sorry, DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Welcome, everybody. I want to start today off and start the week off with something we really haven't done in about 6 weeks, which is just kind of go over what's going on with COVID, because things have changed pretty dramatically over the last 6 weeks. We've not done the weekly COVID updates that at one point we were doing. My thought was, first of all, with so much else going on, there's no shortage of things to talk about. But also, let's really give this Omicron wave 4 to 6 weeks to burn through and see where we are once we close in on mid-February. And for the most part, in the United States, things are looking so much better that there are now what I would call serious discussions about moving into the endemic phase, whereas before there was a lot of kind of hear no evil, see no evil, let's just go back to pretending everything is normal. Things are not normal now, but the discussions about next steps make a lot more sense. And as I've said before, before we look at the numbers, if there is not a more deadly new variant, there is sort of nothing else to wait for before we figure out what will things be like with this as an endemic thing. Now, endemic doesn't necessarily mean no risk. And to many people, it still means a risk. But the question is sort of, if not now, when? Because if we are moving into an endemic phase with no really serious new variant for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, what are we going to do over those 1, 2, or 3 years? If not now, what would be different in 2 years if the situation remains sort of as it is now? Now, one caveat to that is, even though cases are dropping dramatically, as I will soon show you, it's going to take some time for the hospitals to empty out. We are still seeing hospitals quite full right now because of the wave's peak now many weeks ago. And it will take some time for that to abate, assuming there's no new really contagious and or deadly variant. But let's look at where we are right now. If you look at the United States, daily cases are now down from an insane peak of 800,000 cases a day, all the way down to 239,000. Now, that's still a lot. It puts us sort of at the Delta peak, but with a variant with significantly lower rate of hospitalization rate, remember, that's down about almost three quarters. You look at some individual states, you look at New York. New York peaked at 75,000 cases a day and is down to about 8,000, you know, almost a 90% reduction. You look at Massachusetts. Massachusetts peaked at about 24,000 cases a day, down all the way down to 3,000. Okay, that's a massive reduction. Even places like Texas, seeing a reduction only about 50%, but still going in the downward direction. And then when you look globally, the decline is earlier. We are earlier in the decline. We had gotten to 3.3 million global cases a day, now down to 2.7 million. So there are parts of the world that are nowhere near doing well, as we would say. And we will talk about some of those in a moment. But the important thing for our purposes is that we are seeing countries, states, school districts start to talk about what are the next steps. Now, in terms of vaccinating kids under five, there's the hope. I mean, I think that the most optimistic prediction is by March that may start. It's plausible it's not going to be March, and it could be April maybe, or maybe even May. But you are starting to see a lot of places make decisions about travel. For example, Australia, which has been one of the tightest, strictest places since the start of the pandemic, will be reopening borders to international travel, as reported by the BBC. That's from this morning. So Australia starting to open. There are a number of additional European countries that are moving towards what we might call an exit from the pandemic. Italy, Switzerland, and Finland are going to be easing restrictions and guidelines. Germany and Belgium so far are not, but many other countries, Denmark and others, going back to normal, as we might say. still, of course, with the caveat that there are going to be people who are going to continue doing whatever they've been doing. And one of the interesting things that we've talked about before is there's this discussion of when can we treat this like flu? One answer to make it an empirical answer and not an emotional answer, one answer would be when the death rate matches that of flu. That would be something to look at. It is hypothesized that the Omicron overall death rate is about 0.2%. Flu is 0.15. So we're not there yet, but it's going in that direction. One additional caveat to that is the death rate for the vaccinated is significantly lower than the 0.2%. The death rate for the unvaccinated is significantly higher. So what you can safely the framework that you can accurately assess for yourself does depend significantly on whether you are or aren't vaccinated. But one of those questions is, well, when the death rate becomes that of the flu, it would make sense to go back to normal, right? Well, no, the reality is that these 2 years have exposed for a lot of people. I wasn't as safe as I thought during flu season. And there are absolutely people who used to not take any precautions when flu was rampant during flu season. But even if and when COVID risk goes back down to match flu, it will still feel more dangerous and that people will be more aware of that risk. And they may continue to take precautions. And of course, everybody should do exactly what makes sense for them in conversation with doctors and based on their risk assessment. But that's the conversation that's happening. South Korea, as reported by the Korea Herald, pushes to treat COVID-19 like flu. They have lots of cases, but low severity, relatively low hospitalizations, quite a low death rate. So that's the South Korean perspective. In New Jersey, the governor will be ending the school mask mandate next month in March. And there are many municipalities. I saw some in. And by the way, there are places that never did anything. It's like I'm not even talking or thinking about those. I'm talking about places that did stuff are now having conversations. There's some municipalities in Massachusetts that are moving away from the masks. Some in New York, a number of different places. Caveat. Things are still not good in a lot of places. Russia has hit a new record. They currently have 10 times more cases than a month ago, to the extent that we can believe the Russian data. It is now 10 times higher cases than a month ago. That's not good for them. Hong Kong is bracing for more curbs or guidelines, mandates, as cases are doubling every 3 days. Very complicated situation in Hong Kong. China is locking down Bay's city on the Vietnam border as cases are continuing to go up, still low numbers. And of course, China has taken a sort of, at least officially, a zero COVID approach. Now, whether that's zero COVID or zero COVID reporting, you know, there's debate about that, but there are significant lockdowns happening there as well. So what can we do? Well, I think, again, the question is, reminder, we've been here before. What is different now? The difference is there is more support for the discussion now about moving into the endemic phase in terms of public opinion than there ever was before. But there's also more support from medical experts. We spoke to Vincent Racaniello 2 weeks ago. We've read the opinions of many other public health experts. And if things change, it will require a different approach. But if we are going in this direction, then there is this question of what are the milestones we are waiting for? And there are people who are going to keep themselves in a sort of purgatory for a very long time. That's the reality. And every individual has to balance, you know, their risk tolerance, their health situation, and the mental health impact that is undeniable. I mean, you know, the right is not wrong when they say there is a mental health impact of doing this. It's a question of when does the balance shift? And the answer is different for everybody. So we're going to continue monitoring all of these decisions and seeing if the downtrend continues, which if it does, within another 2 weeks, we could be 95 to 97% down in terms of daily cases. And when you have that combined with the effectiveness of vaccines at preventing death, you really have a dramatically different situation to consider. In terms of what every individual wants to be doing. Hey, I have something unbelievable for you. Last week in the morning, Friday morning, Fox News was gleefully predicting a disastrous jobs report. They were doing coverage all morning. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be terrible. They were rooting for our failure, which they say we do, which of course we don't. They were rooting against America. And then the jobs report came in and it was fantastic. It was an incredible jobs report that we actually had. U.S. added over 450,000 jobs in January 2022. Strong demand at restaurants, retailers, mail and parcel delivery. Leisure and hospitality added more than 150,000 jobs. Retail added 61,000. I mean, just incredible numbers. And Fox had to then just go silent. You have to see this. Here is the morning on Fox before the jobs report.
In the next hour, the January job report will be released, and it could be the worst in years.
The White House has been bracing for a bad number.
It could be a loss of 300,000 jobs. Oof. How's the White House going to put a happy face on that?
The real question is, how are you going to put a sad face on the incredible numbers we got?
He thinks that we might see a loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs.
It could be a morning of pain, because just about 28 minutes from right now, the January jobs report is going to be released by the Bureau of Labor and whatnot.
Projection is for an already low 150,000 jobs added, but ADP, the company that processes payrolls, says to expect 301,000 jobs lost.
Uh-oh.
That would be a 500,000 job swing the wrong way.
The Biden administration bracing for yet another economic bust. We're going to bring you the January jobs report.
Soon after.
Well, didn't work out that way.
The January jobs report just released the U.S. adding 467,000 jobs left.
So they did ultimately report on the numbers, and many of these people going completely and totally silent. One funny graphic that they had was this like completely negative, catastrophic, more job losses in huge red font, February 4th, 2022. And of course, it didn't happen. Now, you can always ask questions like, well, what is the quality of these jobs? What are the wages of these? We always ask these questions. This is not a partisan thing for me. I was the first to tell you during the Trump administration, the economy was mostly doing very well. Whether it had anything to do with Trump was a real question. Whether these jobs numbers have anything to do with Biden is a completely fair question. But the rooting against America, which I always thought they said we did, even though they do it, is just another instance of projection. And this is completely beyond parody. This is later on Steve Doocy asking Stuart Varney, how did everybody get it so wrong?
All right. The January jobs report is in. White House should be happy about that. Steve, over to you.
All right. Thank you very much, Carly. Let's bring in Stuart Varney, host of Varney & Company and American Built on Fox Business. Stuart, you know, this morning we were projecting what one estimate was 150,000, or it could have been 300,000 in the hole.
Right.
It's close to 500,000. How did everybody get this so wrong?
Well, you're right. Everybody did get this chronically wrong. I'm not sure I can really explain why we've got this explosion of 467,000 jobs, because it does run counter to what we were expecting. We thought that COVID, or Omicron in particular, would be keeping millions of people at home. They would not be at work, and that would be jobs lost.
Now, what's funny is they didn't originally think that. Like, they downplayed Omicron. They downplayed reports from Fauci and others. We could have 15, 20% of the population out sick. But now they're saying, no, I mean, based on all that stuff, which we rejected for weeks, we were expecting it to be bad.
Well, didn't work out that way. I'm sure that millions of people are at home suffering from Omicron, and these figures were taken in January. But the overall number was still way up there. I can explain one thing here. The unemployment rate went up from 3.9 to 4%. It went up.
Right. Now, that actually isn't necessarily a bad thing. Now, we've talked about, and again, you fact check me. Go back and look at how I cover jobs. Okay. It's not a partisan thing for me. Sometimes the unemployment rate goes up because more people are starting to look for jobs. When you are actively looking for a job, you are considered unemployed. If you stop looking, you are no longer considered unemployed. This was the case under Reagan, under Clinton. This is what it is. And I don't play these games where I ignore how these things are measured depending on who's in the White House. I don't care about political party. What sometimes when the economy is getting better, more people say, I now want to reenter the workforce, and they become considered actively unemployed. So it doesn't tell us much that the unemployment rate went from, I think, 3.9 to 4.0. We're going to continue covering this in the same empirical way that we've been from the beginning. But how sad they were over at Fox that the jobs report was good. Let me know your thoughts. You can find me on Twitter at @dpacman, and we'll be right back. The David Pakman Show is sponsored directly by viewers and listeners who sign up at joinpakman.com. We do an extra show every single day for our members called The Bonus Show. Remember that Alex Jones hates The Bonus Show.
Oh, The Bonus Show, where you want to make money, but everybody else that makes money to fund themselves is bad.
I can think of no greater endorsement for the world famous Bonus Show than Alex Jones being against it.
Thank your lucky stars every day you're not Dave Pakman.
You can sign up at isn't it crazy that this is my job? You can sign up at joinpakman.com and use the coupon code WOW22. I have for you today one of the craziest political stories that I have ever covered. And it might not seem that crazy because it has been slowly building. But former Vice President Mike Pence has now turned on Donald Trump publicly in a speech at the Federalist Society in Florida over the weekend. And Donald Trump has reacted by completely losing it on Mike Pence. It is not normal that a former president and vice president, just 13 months after leaving office, are in such public conflict. Mike Pence publicly now has said that he had no ability or right to overturn the results of the 2020 election. And Trump doesn't like that because Trump wanted Pence to steal the election. This is part of the growing civil war in the Republican Party. And let me tell you clearly and directly, this is not normal. It is not normal for a president and a vice president to have such major public disagreement so quickly after leaving office. And it is not over something minor. This is something major. The ex-president says he won, and the vice president could have flipped the results. The ex-vice president says, we didn't win, and I have no right to change the results. This is a disagreement as big as anybody could imagine, dealing with the most fundamental and crucial elements of how our democracy is supposed to work. Let's go to the clip. Here is Mike Pence.
President Trump said I had the right to overturn the election. But President Trump is wrong. I had no right to overturn the election. The presidency belongs to the American people.
True.
And the American people alone. And frankly, there is no idea more un-American than the notion that any one person could choose the American president. Under the Constitution, I had no right to change the outcome of our election. And Kamala Harris will have no right to overturn the election when we beat them in 2024.
All right. Well, listen, maybe. But Pence is correct in what he is saying there. And Donald Trump very quickly, completely triggered, putting out a statement saying, quote, just saw Mike Pence's statement on the fact that he had no right to do anything with respect to the electoral vote count other than being an automatic conveyor belt for the old crow Mitch McConnell to get Biden elected president as quickly as possible. That was one sentence. Well, the vice president's position is not an automatic conveyor if obvious signs of voter fraud or irregularities exist. That's why the Democrats and rhinos are working feverishly. Interesting. I would describe this statement as febrile. Interesting that Trump uses the word feverishly. Working feverishly together to change the very law that Mike Pence and his unwitting advisors used on January 6th to say he had no choice. The reason they want it changed is because they now say they don't want the vice president to have the right to ensure an honest vote. In other words, I was right and everyone knows it. Now, of course, that's not true. The truth about that is, pre-Trump, there was no disagreement as to the vice president's ability to flip an election because it even came up in 2020. And the now former president was pushing Pence to do this. There is a move to strengthen the language to make it even more clear. But the vice president does not have the opportunity or ability to change election results. Trump lastly says, if, in other words, I was right and everyone knows it, if there is fraud or large scale irregularities, it would have been appropriate to send those votes back to the legislatures to figure it out. The Dems and Rhinos want to take that right away. A great opportunity lost, but not forever. In the meantime, our country is going to hell. Folks, this is not normal. This really is kind of like an end of days type situation, which hopefully just won't actually lead to the end of days. That's the hope, that this is just, okay, yeah, this is crazy, but he's out of power and he's not going to be back in power. That's the optimistic scenario. Now, it's very important to mention at this point, it seems abundantly clear that if Trump does run in 2024 and wins the nomination, his running mate is not going to be Mike Pence. I can only imagine who it would be. That would be an interesting choice, and I would assume it would be someone even more radical than Pence. Now, I think there's an important disclaimer to make here. As far as Pence being the good guy, this is too little too late. It has been 13 months since the attempted insurrection. He was just doing his job. And what I mean by that is he can't overturn the election. It was crazy that Trump even tried to get him to attempt it. Pence caused a ton of damage during his reign as vice president. He said almost nothing about this until now. He doesn't get a medal. Pence is horribly toxic. He couldn't overturn the election. He didn't choose not to overturn it. He couldn't overturn it. All he's saying now is, it's true. I couldn't overturn it. Imagine not killing someone in January of 2021 after your friend urges you. Your friend goes, please kill this person. You don't do it. And then in February of 22, you go, I was right not to kill anybody. Right. Murder's illegal. You don't get a cookie for reminding us that 13 months ago, you did the only thing you could do. You couldn't overturn the election and you didn't. You don't get a cookie for that. Now, what's the upside here? The upside is what we're soon going to discuss, which is that this rift between Pence and Trump adds to the Republican fragmentation. Here's an example. Here is former Trump propagandist Stephen Bannon attacking Pence over this.
Pence, you're going to carry this thing eventually to your grave, okay?
Ooh.
Because it is a mark of shame, and you are a stone cold coward, a stone cold coward. Boris Epstein, we're going to start with numbers and analysis.
Yeah. So Pence could have done nothing else. The only thing Pence could do was not try to overturn the election, because he does not have the right or the power to overturn the election. It was the law. It was the Constitution. But it's furthering the rift within the Republican Party. And I argue that that is a very good thing. Let's talk about that. I'm really glad that something I've been saying for a couple of months now is getting more attention. It's not getting more attention from me saying it, to be clear. What I mean is I'm glad other people are coming to the same conclusion, which is that by all accounts, Republicans should do very well in the upcoming midterms. Now, and we're under 9 months away from the midterms. One of the best chances at Republicans not doing well is the explosion of the internal disagreements and civil war that we're increasingly seeing within the Republican Party, which we have been covering. David Siders and Natalie Allison wrote about this in a piece for Politico called Trump's Circular Firing Squad Threatens Republican Midterm Gains. And this outlines a lot of what we've been saying. And the article says, 9 months before the midterms, nearly everything is falling the Republican Party's way, from Joe Biden's dismal approval ratings to rising gas prices and a seemingly never-ending pandemic. Yet, as the RNC concluded its winter meeting here on Friday, it was censuring two of its own, Representatives Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, and decrying the House's January 6th Select Committee for what Ronna McDaniel, the RNC chair, called the, quote, persecution of ordinary citizens who engaged in legitimate political discourse that had nothing to do with violence at the Capitol. In a year in which even many Democrats acknowledge the Republicans will likely win the House, and despite Republican lawmakers and strategists pleading with Republicans to keep their focus on pocketbook issues and on Biden, the RNC is still recasting the events of January 6th and chasing down enemies of the defeated former President Donald Trump. They go on to say, for all the energy he creates at the party's grassroots, his stranglehold on the party is emerging as one of the biggest threats to the Republicans' otherwise bright prospects in November. He has singled out 10 House Republicans for extinction. He's attacking Republican governors, backing primary challengers, meddling in Senate races where it may lead to the nomination of flawed candidates ill-suited for a general election. He's fomenting rebellion against the party Senate leader Mitch McConnell. And this week in Salt Lake City, it was David Bossie, the former Trump deputy campaign manager, leading the effort to kick Cheney and Kinzinger to the curb. Read the entire article, but it gets to the really key point, which is a sad point for us, right? I care about the left. The left is really failing right now. It's just really failing in terms of setting itself up to do well 9 months from now in the midterms. Sadly, like it really pains me to admit this, but the person best positioned to save the country from Trumpian insanity is Trump and Trumpists sabotaging their own midterms. It's tragically sad that this is the case for the Democratic Party right now. But with under 9 months to go until the midterms, I'll take any help I can get. And so when we see Trump doing this insane stuff, we see Republicans censuring Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney. Last week, I told you that George W. Bush, from another wing of the Republican Party, has donated the maximum allowed by law to both Lisa Murkowski and Liz Cheney, two Republicans that supported the impeachment of Donald Trump. I will take all of it because they're all terrible. Remember, Liz Cheney is not our friend. Liz Cheney, when the rubber met the road, voted with Trump most of the time. So it's all bad. Are we even better off with a non-Trump Republican than a Trump Republican if the non-Trump Republican is slightly less crazy but more likely to get their policies passed? We're poorly off no matter what. So I would love to see the Democratic Party get it together and take advantage of this situation where, for, you know, historically looking, it should not be a great midterm for Democrats, but maybe it could be. This is the biggest gift we could imagine. And so we have to do everything we can to encourage the civil war to continue. We'll have more on this on our Instagram page, which you can find at David Pakman Show. One of the biggest flashpoints in the 2016 presidential election came around records retention, emails, email servers, responsibility with classified and sensitive information, all directed at Hillary Clinton. Remember that this was the biggest storyline about Hillary Clinton. She would be in jail, Trump said, if I was president, because of what she did with emails and documents and so on and so forth. Every day now, I'm not exaggerating, every day, just over the weekend, each day, there was another major story about the Trump White House and records. And we're going to look at two of those stories now. And the first is that essentially a raid took place on Mar-a-Lago, where the National Archives showed up to get Trump's documents, many of which related to meetings with North Korean dictator Kim Jong-un. Remember those love letters? Remember Trump said, and we fell in love. Trump did not turn over the records to the National Archives. He took them to Mar-a-Lago, and the National Archives had to go down there and get the records. This is an incredible story. Washington Post reporters Jacqueline Alemany, Josh Dossi, and others reporting: President Trump improperly removed multiple boxes from the White House that were retrieved by the National Archives last month from his Mar-a-Lago residence. He just took the documents home because they contain documents and other items that should have been turned over to the agency, according to three people familiar with the visit. The recovery of the boxes from Trump's Florida resort raises new concerns about his adherence to the Presidential Records Act, which requires the preservation of memos, letters, notes, emails, faxes, and other written communications related to a president's official duties. Trump advisors deny any nefarious intent, of course, and say the boxes contain mementos, gifts, letters from world leaders. Who could not realize that those are presidential records and other correspondence? The items included correspondence with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which Trump once described as love letters.
And then we fell in love.
Right. Right. As well as a letter left for his successor by President Barack Obama, according to two people familiar with the contents. Discussions between the archives and the former president's lawyers that began last year resulted in the transfer of the records in January. Another person familiar with the materials said Trump advisors discussed what had to be returned in December. People familiar with the transfer spoke on the condition of anonymity. So in December, they explained to Trump what needed to be returned. And it took the National Archives showing up later to actually get the stuff. The archives have struggled to cope with a president who flouted. There it is, guys. See, I told you it's a real word. People always say when I say flouted, David, don't you mean flaunted? And I say, no, I mean flouted. A president who flouted document retention requirements and frequently ripped up official documents, leaving hundreds of pages taped back together. So this is this story, and we're going to talk about the incineration of documents in a moment. This is the prototypical backwards projection scam that was this entire presidency. The story in 2016 was Hillary's going to do bad stuff with records. Hillary can't be trusted with email, documents, classified, secret, sensitive. And since Trump has left, we found out that the real concern around all of those things was Donald Trump and his kids and other people that worked for him. Do we think Hillary would have eaten documents as Donald Trump allegedly did? No. Do we think Hillary would have ripped documents and tossed them onto the floor and then people run in and grab the scraps and tape them back together? Of course not. Do we think Hillary would have taken documents about foreign policy meetings and letters from foreign leaders to her house? Give me a break, guys. And we can argue about anything else about Hillary versus Trump. That's fine. But on this issue, which was the flashpoint about why Hillary can't be trusted, Trump's the guy that we need to worry about. I would love to hear more about the retrieval that took place. And this is not the only story about Trump and White House records that we have today. The next story relates to incineration. So let me reset a little bit. We talked last week about this report that Trump White House staffers regularly had to tape back together things that Donald Trump would rip up. We now have more news about this. Trump White House staffers frequently put important documents into burn bags and sent them to the Pentagon to be incinerated. So you've got conflicting teams. You've got one team that understands Presidential Records Act and preservation of records. When Trump rips stuff up and tosses it, they run in and tape it back together. It's like, if reminded of the movie A Beautiful Mind. Some of you will get that reference. And then at the same time, you've got another team that is collecting records and sending them to be incinerated. Trump era White House staffers frequently put documents in burn bags. Regular burn runs would see these bags taken to the Pentagon for incineration. This is per the Washington Post. It was up to the staffers to decide which documents to preserve and which to destroy. It has been widely reported that Trump had a penchant for tearing apart presidential documents, but details have emerged about how aides disposed of potentially important papers. Burn bags resemble paper grocery bags and are widely available at the White House. Organizations dealing with top secret info like the CIA and NSA often use them because destruction via burn bags is considered superior to shredding. That's true. You can sometimes tape together stuff that's been shredded. You want to use a cross-cut shredder instead of the one that just generates strips, but it's crazy what the kids these days can do. So you burn it. Of course, it appears that it was done with documents that are supposed to be preserved. This was a disaster. It was almost a comical fiasco, the comical element being Trump eating notes. And I told you about this last week. Back in 2018, it was reported by Newsweek, Trump ate a document after Cohen meeting, according to former White House aide Omarosa Manigo Newman. She said she walked in on Trump eating paper after a meeting with lawyer Michael Cohen in what she believed was an effort to destroy sensitive information. I saw him put a note in his mouth. Since Trump was Why is this story so funny, even though it's so insane? Since Trump was ever the germaphobe, I was shocked. He appeared to be chewing and swallowing the paper. It must have been something very, very sensitive. It is genuinely insane that the biggest issue of the 2016 election that Trump made about Hillary was document retention policies. And this was what Donald Trump was doing his entire presidency. And they still have it in for Hillary. Understand that, you know, we covered Trump's rally about 9 days ago in Conroe, Texas. At that rally, he talked about Hillary Clinton and the crowd starts chanting "lock her up." Understand that the origins of "lock her up" are over Hillary's document and email retention concerns that Donald Trump made issue number one during the 2016 election. They now know, or they could know, Trump was eating documents. Trump was ripping up documents. Trump was burning documents. Trump took documents home to Mar-a-Lago. And they still chant "lock her up" about Hillary, who has never even been charged, never mind convicted, of anything related to that. And his supporters will applaud. They'll applaud "lock her up," and they'll applaud Trump's illegal activities where he says, "well, listen, we were just trying to take the election back from the guy who stole it," or whatever. They cheer the corruption and chant "lock her up," even though Trump did far worse when it came to records and retention of documents and proper handling of classified and secret information. They still chant "lock her up." It is a backwards world that we are living in, my friends. And the idea that someday these folks will have a realization, imagine Trump runs in 2024 and we bring up whoever's the Democratic nominee. I mean, whoever just brings up, "hey, listen, don't get scammed again by this con man. In 2016, he told you Hillary was the concern when it came to records." And Trump ate documents, ripped documents, threw them out and had them burned. He is the con man. He was the problem. Don't fall for it again. It's not going to work with these people. They will fall for whatever the 2024 talking point is as willingly and as readily and as quickly as they fell for it in 2016. And that's why the concept of Trump 2024 is so scary. All right. Today I have for your consideration maybe the new most dishonest Fox News graphic of all time. Now, I'm referring, there's a backstory here. A couple months ago, I told you about a different graphic, which at the time I thought might be the most dishonest Fox News graphic of all time. And it was a graphic just meant to make Joe Biden look bad. And it was about the American workforce. And the graphic that Fox News put up compared the Trump workforce at its peak to the Biden workforce in October. And it showed that there were 3 million fewer people in the workforce under Joe Biden in October than under Trump at the peak. Now, when you looked at the graphic, you could immediately see it was an extraordinarily deceptive cherry picking of data. And you could see that they were cherry picking the dates showing Trump in December of 2019, but then Biden in October of 2021 with no real rhyme or reason. It ignores the reality of the pandemic. It includes the reality that you can deceive very easily with labor force participation, because with a growing population, at most times in history, the U.S. has had more people working than ever before and more people not working than ever before. Everything about it was extraordinarily deceptive. But now I have a new graphic that might actually be even more dishonest and deceptive. On the Dan Bongino Fox show, or Bongino might have just been a guest, I don't know if he was the host here, they put up a graphic called Top 10 Most Unhealthy U.S. Cities. And the whole point of the segment is to say Democrats say they're going to fix problems, but they actually create problems. Look at all of these Democratic cities and how unhealthy they are. And you look at the map and they say, "oh, Portland, Maine is one of the most unhealthy cities in the U.S. And right away, you might be thinking, "wait, what? Portland, Maine? Why is Portland an unhealthy city?" Seattle, Washington, Portland, Portland, Oregon, that is. San Francisco, Honolulu. Wait, isn't Hawaii super healthy? Why is Honolulu? So it looked like a weird graphic. And they cite a source, and the source is WalletHub. So maybe you think WalletHub is reliable, maybe you don't. It doesn't matter. But right away, we should be asking, is this actually what the WalletHub article says? And if you go to the story on WalletHub, which we are linking to, you see that their map is actually the healthiest cities, not the least healthy cities. The healthiest cities that are identified are the ones that on the map Fox News says are unhealthy. San Francisco, Seattle, Washington, Portland, Oregon, San Diego, California, Honolulu, D.C., Austin, Irvine, Portland. So you immediately notice, first of all, they list Irving, Texas, when it's actually Irvine, California on the map. And these are the healthiest cities, not the least healthy. If you actually look at the unhealthiest U.S. cities, according to this analysis, they are Brownsville, Texas, Laredo, Texas, Gulfport, Mississippi, Shreveport, Louisiana, Memphis, Tennessee, Montgomery, Alabama, Fort Smith, Arkansas, Jackson, Mississippi. Not exactly liberal cities. If you look at the most obese cities in America, which is a factor in health, McAllen, Texas is the most obese city in the country. Memphis, Baton Rouge, Little Rock, Shreveport, Birmingham, Jackson, Mobile, Lafayette. It is truly pathetic. And this is where I came up with this acronym CAPS. CAPS stands for Critically Analyze Primary Sources. So when you're presented with a graphic like this and it says top 10 most unhealthy U.S. cities, your first question should be, is this a primary source? And of course, it's not. The primary source here is WalletHub. So your first step should be to go and look at WalletHub. When you look at WalletHub, if you identify it as the primary source, then you would say, OK, now let me critically analyze this. Well, what did WalletHub do? WalletHub looked at the 180 most populated U.S. cities. They looked at 44 indicators of health, and these are what they are. And then you can actually say to yourself, is this the right analysis? Is the analysis done correctly? What's being excluded? What's being included? But most importantly, does the data match what Fox is giving us? And the answer is, of course, it doesn't. Of course, it doesn't. It's the opposite with the additional typo where they put Irving, Texas on the map instead of Irvine, California. An absolute and total humiliation. I would argue the most humiliating graph or chart that I've ever seen on Fox News. If you have a counterpoint, if you have one you think is more embarrassing or humiliating, let me know. I would love to hear it. And by the way, a couple different Dan Bongino stories. One, he's been kicked off of YouTube for spreading COVID disinformation. And number two, they actually, the Bongino people reached out to me a couple weeks ago, inviting me on to talk about some kind of book ban thing that I hadn't heard about on a Friday night. I wasn't available. Should I appear on that show if they invite me again? I'd be interested in hearing from you. I don't know that they will because I turned them down. But if they invite me again, should I appear with Dan Bongino? Let me know. info@davidpakman.com. Sometimes, you know, when you follow a story for a while, it's actually rewarding. It's actually rewarding because you can see the evolution of lies from people. And that is exactly what I have for you today. The headline is, we have now learned Republican Congressman Jim Jordan did talk to Donald Trump on the morning of the January 6th Trump riots for at least 10 minutes straight, just the two of them on the phone. You might say, why is that a story? It's a story because for a year plus now, Jim Jordan has been deliberately deceptive about his conversations with Donald Trump on the day of the Trump riots. So let's start with the news. Newly obtained records show Trump and Jim Jordan spoke at length on the morning of January 6th. The House Select Committee investigating the insurrection now has records which provide details about a phone call Donald Trump made to Jim Jordan on January 6th. Two sources who reviewed the call records tell CNN Trump spoke on the phone at the White House residence with Jordan for 10 minutes on the morning of January 6th. Why do we care about that? We care about that because we want to have Jim Jordan tell us, what was Trump planning? What was Trump hoping would happen on that day? And for as long as Jim Jordan says, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I spoke to him before or after. I don't know if I spoke to him at all. No, I did, but I'm not sure. We have more trouble to the extent that we can't prove this conversation took place, holding Jim Jordan accountable to get him to either tell us what Trump said on that day or to say, I'm going to plead the fifth or whatever the case may be. A key focus of the committee's investigation has been on the run up to the insurrection and the myriad ways Trump and his allies, including those in Congress, spoke to Trump, tried to overturn the election results. The new details about the morning phone call comes as the committee is debating whether to move forward with a subpoena for Jordan after he refused to voluntarily appear for an interview. So now we know that he did speak to him on that morning. Here is the deceiving, constant backstory with Jim Jordan. First of all, remember when he spoke to Olivia Beavers from Politico, where he said, quote, look, I definitely spoke to the president that day. I don't recall. I know it was more than once. I just don't recall the times. He was then asked about it by Brett Baier. Let's listen to what he had to say then.
He's obviously going to go down a number of different roads about who knew what, when, who was talking to coordinators of the protest. Did you talk to the former president that day?
I've talked to the former president umpteen times, thousands. I mean, I may not thousands,
on
times,
January
but countless,
6th.
Countless times. I talked to the president. I never talk about what we talk about because I just don't think that's appropriate. Just like I don't talk about what happens in Republican.
Now, remember, Brett Baier didn't ask what you talked about. He said, did you talk to him on that day? And Jim Jordan says, I've talked to him many times, but I don't talk about what we talked about. The question was, did you talk to him on that day?
Conferences. Sure. So I've talked to the president numerous times. I continue to talk to the president since he's
left
office.
No, I mean on January 6th, Congressman.
Yes. I mean, I've talked to the president. I've talked to the president so many. I can't remember all the days I've talked to him, but I've certainly talked to the president.
Yeah. And on that day was... can you share any of the insight of what he was thinking about that day?
Brett, the people we need to come testify are the people who can testify to the fundamental questions. Why didn't the United States Capitol, the People's House, have an appropriate security posture on
now,
that?
What's funny is the committee has decided Jordan should testify, but he's refusing to go.
That day, and what have we done? Those are the people we need to hear from. Yeah. Those are that's the information and testimony we need to get. That's what we should focus on. But I don't think that Benny Thompson, the chairman of this committee, said everything's on the table until we raise this issue about the speaker's office is the one who knows what the security posture and why it was the way it was.
Okay, so he didn't answer. Shortly thereafter, a couple weeks later, he was then interviewed again, and this was on Spectrum News. And just as evasive.
There's some confusion over what you told Brett Baier on Fox News on Tuesday night. So I want to clear it up. First off, yes or no, did you speak with President Trump on January 6th?
Yeah, I mean, I spoke with the president last week. I speak with the president all the time. I spoke with him on January 6th. I mean, I talk with President Trump all the time. And that's I don't think that's.
So here it was no longer tenable to maintain he didn't speak to Trump on the 6th. So here he conceded I did speak to him on the 6th.
Unusual. I would expect members of Congress to talk with the president of the United States when they're trying to get done the things they told the voters in their district to do. I'm actually kind of amazed sometimes that people keep asking this. But of course, I talk to the president all the time.
Well,
I talk to him
like- the reason people keep asking is because he was not directly saying I spoke to him on January 6th.
Like I said, I talked with him last week.
On January 6th, did you speak with him before, during, or after the Capitol was attacked?
I'd have to go. I spoke with him that day after, I think after. I don't know if I spoke with him in the morning or not. I just don't know.
He just doesn't know. Now, it is completely implausible that even if you bought at the time, the first time he was asked, did you talk to him that day? Let's give him the benefit of the doubt, because this is how you have to think about how absurd this was. Imagine that Jim Jordan really speaks to Trump every day. And asked a month later, did you speak to him on January 6th? Imagine he genuinely doesn't remember. I don't believe that for a second. I believe he remembers. But let's give him the benefit of the doubt. Once it is asked on Fox News and the answer is so obviously deceptive, there is no way in hell that amongst his, you know, plentiful staff, no one comes to him and says, sir, you spoke to Trump twice on January 6th, including before the riot. So now, you know, there is no way after that he doesn't remember. And here he is still saying, I just don't know. Was it before or after? Now, of course, on a day that's that momentous, it's sort of like if I think back to 9/11, right? I remember where I was. And I can tell you with certainty what happened after or before. Like if you say to me, did you work on 9/11? I remember that. Yes, I worked on 9/11. I remember talking to my colleagues about what was going on. And so if you say, and were you at work at all before the events took place? I can say, of course not. There was no period that day where while at work, I learned about what was happening. My entire day at work on 9/11, I was in high school at the time, was after the events took place. When I went in, it was like, are we even staying open? This is crazy, et cetera. There's no doubt about it because it's a notable event. And so this idea that, oh, yeah, well, did you speak to him at all before the riot? Or obviously the conversation would either be, what is Trump expecting to happen? Or what is Trump how is Trump reacting to what is happening? It's just completely implausible that he doesn't remember.
I'd have to go back and I mean, I don't know that when those conversations happened.
Give me a break.
But what I know is I spoke with him all the time. But Taylor, the key here is the people we need to speak to, the people we need to talk to, are the ones who can answer the question, why wasn't there a better security presence?
Yeah, now, Jim, you're one of the people that we actually need to be talking to. So obvious liar. And now, I mean, listen, it took 14 months. 14 months we've been following this. Jim Jordan spoke to Trump that morning before the riot. And so Jim Jordan could tell us, did Trump say anything about hoping that there was violence? Did Trump say anything about what he was expecting Mike Pence to do? This is the guy that we should be talking to. And they tried to talk to him and he's refusing to appear. We have a voicemail number. That number is 2192 David P. Here is a voicemail that is going to upset people in my audience because it is someone saying, hey, David, as progressives, maybe we shouldn't be so anti-cryptocurrency. Uh-oh, this will upset some people. Take a listen.
Hey, David, this is Huvian from Minneapolis. I wanted to call and commend you on your balanced stance on crypto and NFTs. I'm a progressive and also a crypto investor, and I'm just saddened because I see like so many progressive thought leaders demonizing the entirety of crypto without entertaining like reasonable discourse on how to properly regulate it. I mean, it seems like they're like Trump-like with their rhetoric sometimes. To me, the problem is like crypto is such a big idea. It's like the internet. So like to paint the entire sector as a Ponzi or scam rises to almost Trumpian levels of immaturity. It's not perfect and it needs regulation, but there's a reason this thing continues to grow. And I think I think it's here to stay. And I fail to see how progressives win by demonizing it. I mean, they might even win like some votes by helping lead the discussion on reasonable regulatory policy.
Yeah, listen, this is really painful to me that there is such a lack of balance from many of my friends on the left on this issue of cryptocurrency. It's almost like it's a trigger word. You hear cryptocurrency or you hear the word Bitcoin and it's immediately like, no, bad, scam, illegal, crime, right away. And there's also kind of like a naivete or maybe an arrogance to think that you know the future of this entire space, that you know whether this is something that's going to be viable or not. I think some humility should tell us we don't know. And that's kind of the whole point. Cryptocurrency is clearly here to stay to some degree. Been around more than a decade. Major Wall Street financial advisories now say to most people, it's not unreasonable to have, you know, 1-3, 2-4% of assets in cryptocurrency for diversification. It's volatile, but it's been around a long time. There are cryptocurrency ETFs moving in the direction of mutual funds. We don't have to like it, but the idea that any second it's going to evaporate seems increasingly unlikely. Now, I think the other thing that's important is a lot of the bullet points. And again, just as a reminder, I don't care about cryptocurrency any more than I care about mutual funds or stocks. Like, I want to just have a properly diversified asset allocation for my risk tolerance with my money. That's all I care about. Sometimes you'll hear, well, crypto is mostly being held by wealthy people. Right. Just like the U.S. dollar. I mean, this is a systemic problem. Money is mostly in the hands of the wealthy. That's not unique to cryptocurrency. So is that really the issue? Not to me. Is crypto used to complete criminal transactions? Yeah, some. I mean, apparently not that much. One interesting thing was when the Silk Road got shut down, it was believed that the Silk Road was basically the vast majority of Bitcoin transactions. And with the Silk Road shut down, Bitcoin transactions would fall to almost zero. It didn't happen. Crypto transactions barely declined when the Silk Road was shut down. The dollar has been used for way more crimes than Bitcoin has. It's just a reality. It doesn't tell us one thing or the other. I'm not defending anything. Does Bitcoin mining, not all crypto, but does Bitcoin mining have a carbon footprint? Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's imperative. I mean, it's not going to be sustainable unless that's dealt with either through alternative energy. Like, that's a problem that's got to be dealt with. And also, the legacy dollar and banking industry has an insane carbon footprint. All the dollars that are brought by tourists to Europe are then flown back to the U.S. Do you understand the carbon footprint of that? Armored cars everywhere, insane infrastructure of banks, the overhead, they have private jets. I mean, it's, if you want to talk about that, let's talk about it, but let's also consider other banking and monetary instruments in the carbon footprint. People hear this and they go, but it's not the same. Well, just compare one by one. And my view on crypto is nothing is only good. The internet, oh my God, child porn, scams. Right. But the internet exists and it's going to exist. So we've got to control the child porn and the scams. The stock market, it's rife with scammers, fake financial advisors, Ponzi schemes. Yes, we have to deal with that. But investors, investing in the stock market is not going to end. Cars, I mean, they put out emissions and people die in car accidents. Yeah, but cars are going to exist. At this point, we're not getting rid of cars. So let's make them green. Let's switch to electric. Let's make them safer. Let's redesign our roads. I'm not even an evangelist that it crypto exists. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I put a small portion of my assets in monthly dating back to 2015. And that's it. I don't have all my eggs in there. If crypto ends and goes to zero, I lose what is now 3 to 5%. If it does well, then I do it. It's not something in and of itself that we should have this reflexive reaction to. And the problem is that when the left takes that view, they just miss out on participating in how to properly regulate crypto, and they leave it to, I don't know, the libertarians or whoever. Let's take a more balanced view, please. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at JoinPath.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz. Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
Holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Chad, Guinea, Sudan, Burkina Faso over the last 18 months. Several of the coups were led by U.S.-trained officers. We'll get the latest. Then to Minneapolis, where protests are continuing after police fatally shot Amir Locke, a 22-year-old black man who was sleeping on a couch during an early morning no-knock raid.
They saw a black man reach for his gun, not knowing anything about Amir. And then they shot. I mean, they didn't even give him a chance.
We'll speak to attorney Ben Crump, representing Amir Locke's family. Plus, we go to Oakland, where a group of teachers have entered the eighth day of a hunger strike to protest a plan to close and merge over a dozen schools.
Oakland is not for sale. No school closures.
Oakland is not for sale.
No school closures.
We'll speak with one of the striking teachers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden said Monday that a Russian-built pipeline to carry natural gas to Germany will be abandoned if Russia invades Ukraine. Biden made the remarks during a joint news conference at the White House with Germany's new chancellor, Olaf Scholz. Scholz did not explicitly state Germany would suspend the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, though he said the U.S. and Germany were aligned in their positions. In Brussels, European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the EU is exploring other options for its energy supplies, which would include fracked gas from the United States.
We are building a partnership for energy security with the United States, which is primarily about more liquefied natural gas supplies. We are talking to other gas suppliers, for example, Norway, about increasing their supplies to Europe.
Also on Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron met Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin. Putin said Russia is still working to find a diplomatic solution to the crisis over Ukraine, but warned of a wider nuclear-armed confrontation if Ukraine joins the NATO military alliance. The Washington National Cathedral rang its bell 900 times on Monday in a somber tribute to 900,000 U.S. residents who've died of COVID-19. At the Capitol, members of Congress held a moment of silence and candlelight vigil to mark the occasion. The U.S. has a far higher per capita death rate from COVID-19 than other wealthy nations, even though vaccines have been widely available to most U.S. residents for months. Meanwhile, an increasing number of Democratic governors have announced plans to roll back mask mandates. California, Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, and Oregon said they'll end statewide mask mandates, but would allow municipal governments and school boards to require masking. This is New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy.
We're not going to manage COVID to zero. We have to learn how to live with COVID as we move from a pandemic to the endemic phase of this virus.
The Homeland Security Department has confirmed it's testing robot dogs on patrols along the U.S.-Mexico border. The agency said the four-legged drones produced by the Philadelphia-based company Ghost Robotics would help boost the presence of Border Patrol in the region. Officials also admitted the harsh terrain in the southern border can be life-threatening and that robots would reduce the agent's exposure to the hazards. Last year, at least 650 migrants died while attempting to cross into the U.S. as the Biden administration continued to block most asylum seekers from safely coming into the country through posts of entry. In October, Ghost Robotics showed off an autonomous weapons system combining a quadruped robot with a sniper rifle. Costa Rica's crowded presidential election is likely headed to a runoff as preliminary results show